Hi, Nina.
Hi, Sam.
So I'd like to start by introducing you to Hannah, who lives in the Red Hook neighborhood of Brooklyn in New York City, and she keeps backyard chickens.
There we are. Oh, there we are.
Hello, you're Hannah.
Hi, Hannah.
Samantha.
Nice to meet you, Samantha.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you. I'm just going to make some tea or coffee, and then we can go in the backyard and see the chickens.
That would be lovely.
Got it. I'm kind of used to it with the chickens. Like, people often have questions, whether it's because they want to raise chickens or, like, and enough people know about me and my chickens that it's not that uncommon to get some somewhat random email about somebody wants to meet the chickens. I'm like, sure.
I like the little evidence of hay everywhere. So what did your landlord say when you asked to get chickens?
Well, when I moved here, I already had the chickens, so it was sort of a condition of moving in.
Take me and my chickens or nobody. Oh, look. Here they are. Oh, they're getting excited. Hello. Hello. So... how are these ladies for egg laying?
I get one or two eggs. I guess I get, yeah, one or two eggs every day or every other day, but when they're in their prime, they lay an egg a day. So with three hens, I get a lot of eggs.
Yeah.
There's just nothing like it, right? And then you're spoiled and you go to a diner or something and you're just like, this isn't an egg. It has no taste. It has no color. The interesting thing for me about keeping chickens in the city is that it's different from keeping chickens in the country. I grew up on a small farm and we had lots of chickens, smaller space and neighbors, and also just how to get things. It's different.
There isn't regular hay delivery over in Red Hook, Brooklyn.
There are pet stores nearby that sell chicken feed, though. There are enough people keeping chickens around here that the pet stores will carry it.
There are?
Yeah.
How would you, how many people would you imagine have backyard chickens?
I have no idea, but enough that the pet stores will stock the feed. I mean, I think probably a lot more than anybody realizes, because you don't see it. No, you know, it's in people's backyards.
I guess you don't take them.
And if they're doing a good job, it's discreet. It shouldn't smell or be noisy or anything if they're doing a good job, so.
I guess you don't take them for a walk around the block with a leash to show that you have chickens,
no.
So.
We were joking about it, though. Let them get them a little harness and let them stretch their legs.
So those chickens sound cute, but really not my thing. Lots of work for a few eggs. So Sam, what do these chickens have to do with innovation?
Well, fair question. Since the invention of the egg carton by our friend Joseph Coyle, who for our listeners you will remember we introduced you to back in episode 1, with the industrialization of egg production, no one in North America really needs to keep backyard chickens. What we want to explore in this episode is what's going on with people reviving, redoing, and renewing old technologies, old ways of doing things, like raising backyard chickens. It's a trend that's not going away.
Actually, now that you mention it, I remember back in April 2015, the Toronto media covering a story that an American company who rents Urbanites chickens and chicken gear was expanding into Toronto. So clearly there is a demand.
Yes, a demand from the very committed fresh egg lovers.
And keeping backyard chickens, it does seem to fit into a larger trend of reviving old ways of doing things that seem redundant. In our neighborhood, you don't have to look very far to find a course on how to pickle, how to knit, how to bind your own books, and make your own candles.
So what's going on here? Is it just that people enjoy old school things? Is it a trendy bandwagon? Or is it something else? So can you just tell me, can you introduce yourself and your name and where we are right now?
Yeah, my name is Julian Seth Wong. I'm the owner and manager of Tonality Records here at 2168 Dundas Street West.
In?
In Toronto.
Do you know that in the last couple of years, two new record shops, one of them being Tonality, have opened up within walking distance of my house? I decided to stop by one day and chat with Julian about why records and record players that once used to choke garage sales are now enjoying such a huge revival.
I think there's a certain nostalgia with vinyl that people don't really want to leave behind. I know some people argue that sound quality is better with vinyl. I know there's a certain warmness to it, and it really depends on the setup that you're running it on too. I mean, like CDs, you will generally get better sound, but it's not as intimate, right? I mean, there's a certain ritual with listening to vinyl. Mm-hmm. It's been around for a long time.
So you were saying that in the 1990s, tell me that story again about Madonna and vinyl.
Yeah, in the 90s, vinyl kind of went obsolete. But I know that Madonna actually had it in her contract that in order to release music, she had to put it out on vinyl, which is why you'll see a ton of Madonna vinyl, but probably nothing else. In the 90s, you know, vinyl became really expensive to press, and it became really expensive to purchase, too. So a lot of records that were pressed in the 90s are becoming more and more expensive now.
So tell me about this store and what it does.
Tonality basically started out as a peering into my mind. It's sort of a collaboration of all of my favorite things in one store. I've always been a collector of vinyl, and I realized that a lot of the stuff that I like to collect wasn't really widely available here in Toronto. So it's sort of a means of introducing new bands and sort of smaller, lesser-known artists.
Mm-hmm. And how is the opening going? How is the launch?
It's been pretty good. It's been really positive. A lot of people are really enjoying the idea.
So when people come in, well, tell me about who comes into your store and who are your best customers? What are they like? What's their demographic?
Surprisingly, there's a wide range of customers. I was expecting, you know, like mid-20s customers to be kind of my strong point, but I have people in their late 50s come in and get all excited about the vintage gear that we have in the back area, that, you know, stuff that they've owned in their early ages, and seeing it again just kind of brings a light to their eyes, and that's really awesome. But, you know, a lot of my customers now, I find that when they come in and they find something that they like, they're back every week to find something new, and they come in for recommendations and they listen to stuff, and it's really awesome to see people find music that they enjoy.
How can you open the store? Why are you connected to vinyl so explicitly now in your life?
I started it about 5 years ago, which isn't too long for a lot of people. In the beginning, I had no idea that modern bands were pressing vinyl. I was collecting, you know, like 60s and early 50s jazz releases and whatnot on vinyl. And then I started going to places like, you know, Sonic Boom and Rotate This and Grasshopper Records here in Toronto, and realized how many of my favorite bands and bands that my friends and peers listen to nowadays are still putting things out on vinyl. But with me getting into vinyl, I feel like it's one of those things that some people look at as pretentious. I know that's sort of like a well-known thing about, or sort of a stigma with vinyl, but I think that it's worth keeping alive. And that's one of the reasons that I opened this store, is just to try to keep that joy alive.
What's so impressive about this revival that Julian is prepared to bank on is that 10 years ago, vinyl seemed dead. Okay, some history. When the switch to CDs happened back in the early 1990s, it was quick. Remember what Julian said? Vinyl was so expensive to press compared to CDs that it became almost obsolete. And in the early 2000s, vinyl was in real trouble. And this trend continued until 2005, when sales shrunk by a further 30%. And then, in 2007, an idea.
An idea? Okay, what happened? What could turn around the fate of vinyl?
Well, according to Billboard magazine, independent music stores had started to notice that the number of vinyl customers was slowly growing. Huh. A sales opportunity. So what did they do? A collection of independent record stores got together and started Record Store Day back in 2008. And guess what? Huge success. It created a surge of interest to buy music on vinyl all over again. That year, record sales grew by 90% and have continued to grow year after year since then.
You know, it's interesting, and maybe a sign of my age. I thought it was older people who were keeping vinyl alive, people who'd grown up with records. But Julian was expecting younger people to be his biggest customers. So, who brought vinyl back? Old fogies or young hipsters?
Well, as we heard from Julian at his store Tonality, people of all ages are interested in vinyl. But when you look at the market research, it's proportionately younger people who are buying it. It's actually people under 25, those folks who didn't grow up with vinyl everywhere. So why, we ask ourselves, why bother with the cumbersome cases of vinyl and the turntable that's hard to service? Well, the theory is that for music lovers, vinyl is love. It's tangible. It has a ritual, taking the record out of the sleeve, putting it on the turntable, hearing the needle fit the groove, and, oh, that beautiful warm sound.
I guess the convenience of streaming or MP3 files on the smartphone just isn't enough. So are we proving that creative destruction, that process where innovation sweeps away the old and brings in the new, isn't all it's cracked up to be?
Well, I don't think we just jettison old ways of doing things, toss it over and start again. If you look around, you see lots of evidence that what's useful does remain. Think about modes of transport. We didn't get rid of the bicycle when cars and mass transit came along. Bicycles stuck around because they can be much more convenient and certainly cheaper.
Yes, but the idea that contemporary technology will destroy old ways of doing things is in the zeitgeist. The idea that new innovations will replace something we already have has resonance. Just think of ebooks. When they came on the scene, there were pronouncements of the end of the paper book. And our own example of vinyl. When you can have almost all the music the world has to offer on a streaming service, why would you continue buying old records?
So what and who is behind all the hype that new technology leads to creative destruction? Who gets to decide what technology wins? And then, what's old and done? Well, we found an academic who's actually done a lot of thinking about this exact question.
Yeah, so thanks very much for having me on your podcast. My name is Eliane Glazer, and I'm a writer and lecturer here in the UK. I live in London and I teach at Bath Spa University, which is in the west of England.
We spoke to Eliane recently about her book, Get Real, How to Tell It Like It Is in a World of Illusions. Her book unpacks many powerful social narratives, and in particular, she takes aim at the concept that capitalism is natural, that it's the only way to divvy up power and resources.
I think that in the past, there was a sort of healthy antagonism between the people and financial, corporate and political elites. And it was a sort of us and them situation that we as citizens knew that we were being sold to, that companies were selling us products and so on, and through advertising and commercial culture. But it was... It was a healthy antagonism in the sense that there was a division between the people and corporations, or the people and financial interests, or the people and politicians. And I think that what we've seen more recently is a form of convergence between the corporations and the people, so that our consent and our participation has been asked for in various overt and covert ways, so that we now participate in corporate culture, in commercial culture, and our participation is expected, and whether that's sharing a viral video advertising a product or allowing companies to harvest our personal data and sell it on to other companies. So whereas before you might have had capitalism existing as an approach to the world, an ideology amongst other competing ideologies. Capitalism is talked about as a force of nature.
So how can we imagine this? Black Friday is a storm blowing in off the lake? But we all shop, we all consume, so why is this different now? What has changed?
When the archetypal corporation was McDonald's, you know, then we could all kind of have this very self-aware opposition to these corporations and corporate forces. But now that the archetypal corporation is, say, Google or Starbucks, that those corporations now have adopted ethical or funky, down-to-earth, you know, people-centred modes of operation, and their reputation and the imagery that they use in their advertising and their branding is very sort of authentic and about ordinary people, championing ordinary people. I mean, I don't think we're stupid as citizens, but I think it's very difficult to detect the ways that we're being duped if corporate culture is dressed up in this very kind of folksy, artisanal, down-to-earth people power sort of camouflage. And, you know, I mean, one example of that is Starbucks having these unbranded community personality cafes, I think they're called, where there's a notice board advertising local events. The coffee beans are very ostentatiously displayed as being fair trade and are in a kind of a nice rustic burlap sack, coffee plants on the counter and so on. And so this kind of unbranded corporate culture, which seems very local and artisanal, it's misleading in terms of its actual mode of operation, its actual monopolistic mode of operation. And you get the same thing with tech companies. Google and Facebook are very, very much about empowerment, participation, user-generated content, transparency, you know, ethical practices, and so on. And they're still utterly dominant in terms of their influence over our lives, and incredibly monopolistic in terms of their market share. But this is disguised by the way that they come across.
Okay, I like where Eliana's going. Corporations are now trying to be more like personalities, trying to be our friends. But how does this link with people keeping backyard chickens and listening to music on vinyl?
Well, remember what Eliane was describing when she went into a Starbucks somewhere? You know, how it made you feel all at home, like you're all cozy and you're wearing a sweater and you're sitting in a comfy chair, and now you know the name of the coffee picker of the beans that you're drinking? Well, for me, for a moment, I'm there. I believe it. But then it feels hollow. So I think what's happening is that some people are abandoning these corporate manufactured experiences and seeking out their own authentic experiences. And I'm bringing this around, like rearing your own chickens that make fantastic tasting eggs, or buying music from a real person at a store in a format you can touch and bring home in a bag.
So is it like when you read a book on Kindle? You don't get the same degree of pleasure as you do from holding a book in your hands. It's different. It may be more convenient, but to me, it doesn't feel quite real. Kind of hollow, like you said.
I think so. When you listen to Eliane, she explains how digital culture seems to want to dispense with these touchy-feely, human-centered experiences. But people, on the other hand, don't seem ready to give up on them just yet.
The survival, and in fact, you know, the increasing popularity of some of those forms of heritage or dinosaur technology is really, really interesting. And with the technological innovation of the internet, all periods and all ages and all eras are simultaneously available to us. So while it might seem an incongruity that you have vinyl existing at the same time as an MP3 file, it's actually a characteristic of the internet and digital culture to have different periods in play at all times. And you see this very much in terms of the music that's available on the internet. The historical particularity of music has been flattened, so it's all available all at the same time. And I think a similar thing goes for technologies themselves. That I think also the modernity of digital culture and technological innovation itself has produced a form of nostalgia or a kind of desperate desire to retain the historical, really, to retain history and memory in an era where everything is new and everything is now. I think there's another thing as well, which is that a lot of the new technologies are just kind of disappointing. There are lots of examples of that where the actual content, the product that you're getting is the same, but actually there hasn't been a tangible improvement to the consumer from the technological innovation. It's just been an upgrade that requires you to buy a new piece of kit. So I think that a lot of these technological innovations haven't actually brought real gains to people, and that's why possibly they're going back to things like vinyl, because, you know, it's so easy just to put a record on as opposed to, you know, opening a laptop, you know, which then means you then look at your email and then suddenly you're working just to listen to some music on iTunes or whatever. And I think also people love the crackle and hiss that you get from a record, from vinyl. And I think that that again provides us with a kind of a sense of authenticity and history and the real, which digital culture has dispensed with in a lot of ways.
This reminds me of a story. Last summer, I was at a friend's cottage where the only thing to watch was old VHS movies on an old tube TV. I've never been so happy to see a VHS in my life. Not a fight about which Netflix stream to watch and which screen goes where. I marveled at the pure simplicity of it and that the lack of choice was so liberating. As a parent, I didn't have to get involved, but also that it was a tangible thing. My kids got a kick out of holding something in their hands. It's not just about nostalgia. It's about choice and about having too much of it.
I think there's also, there's a real tyranny in choice, that actually choice, there's a lot of evidence that choice makes us unhappy. And also I think there's really an issue about abundance. I'm very interested in which things in our culture are abundant and which ones are scarce. Those things are changing all the time at the moment. So things like music and books, you know, as books are digitized, those things are becoming incredibly abundant. But I think that that abundance is creating difficulties for us, because I think that we structure our lives according to narratives. And if you have scarcity, then you have a narrative because you have the search to find something. And I mean, I've spoken to people, so many people who were desperate to find that their favourite song on the radio and listened to the radio to wait until the song came on. And then they rushed over to the tape recorder and pressed record to capture this precious song. You know, and I think that that scarcity gives you meaning and it gives you something to aim for, which we need as humans.
I know what she means. Things don't seem as precious when they're at your fingertips. So what else does Elian have to say about our relationship with tech innovation and how it transforms our experiences around choice, abundance and scarcity?
Well, I guess I'm interested in who or what is driving change. I think the problem is that it's not humans that's driving change. It's a handful of powerful and wealthy corporate and financial interests, and they're driving change. So they're producing the iPhones and the smartphones, which we're all addicted to. So, you know, in this great age of modernity and freedom, it's as if suddenly our lives are governed by all these forces of determinism, so technological determinism. Who says that technology has to develop in a certain way? It's not a natural or inevitable thing that we walk around staring at smartphones.
Smartphone addiction. Yes, guilty. But they really are helpful tools. I'm not chained to my desk anymore waiting for a fax or a phone call to come through. But I suppose what Elian is asking is this. Did I actually have the choice to start using a smartphone? Or did that choice get made for me? But wait, let's think back. Was there ever a time when we controlled the development of technology rather than it controlling us? Haven't we always been controlled, obsessed, and determined by the tools that we use?
I always think about farmyard equipment and sort of agricultural tools, you know, the tools which were in the past were honed over generations, and that was something like a kind of form of Darwinian evolution. So you'd have a tool that you used, you know, to harvest your wheat or whatever, a scythe. And over the generations, farmers would notice that actually if the handle was a bit longer or the blade was a bit more curved, it was a more effective tool. So you'd have these very small incremental changes which were ergonomic and which happened because of the actual everyday use, you know, to which they were put. But I think that now change happens and technological change happens in this much more top-down way, which is ironic given that Darwinian evolution is so dominant as a discourse. But actually the way that technological innovation happens is in this top-down corporate way.
So I wonder how the concept of creative destruction fits into Elian's critique.
It's really interesting, that concept. But I suppose my interest in particular is the fact that this idea of creative destruction, who's talking about it and to what end? So my concern is that tech companies are applying this concept of creative destruction in a very gung-ho kind of way to institutions that they regard as the old kind of cultural gatekeepers, you know, whether that's higher education, journalism, broadcasting, and culture and the arts. And it's those areas that creative destruction is being advocated in this very boosterish kind of way. And actually, those are the kinds of institutions and values that I really value. You know, I really value professionalism, professional standards, knowledge, beauty, culture, expertise. You know, but these are really becoming regarded as elitist in this sort of fake horizontalist, fake democratic world that we're now entering, which is kind of curated by tech moguls, you know, in the name of ordinary people. It's all about political choices, really. And so I suppose my main argument is that technology is not a natural force that just evolves and we just have to keep up, we just have to follow it. My argument is that it's always driven by political choices.
So this is a podcast about innovation, and yet what we've done in this episode is talked about keeping backyard chickens and listening to vinyl records, two activities that could have easily been swept away by newer innovations.
And we introduced you to Eliane, who gave us some pretty good reasons to be sceptical about how innovation is presented today and to be a bit wary about the hype of creative destruction, especially when it comes from the tech elite.
So we heard Eliane's thoughts. But what do you think's going on, Sam? Why is old school so appealing?
Well, the way I see it, the more advanced technology gets, the more introverted we seem to become with our devices. And yet, against this grain, I notice there's a simultaneous rise in vinyl record shops and board game cafes and meetups about backyard chickens. All places where you can go and enjoy old-fashioned human contact. And then consider what it takes to collect vinyl. Think of the physical space that it occupies. Isn't it amazing that so many younger people who might be in shared homes or apartments are still prepared to give up valuable real estate to turntables and speakers? All for the pleasure of touching music, the experience you cannot get from your smartphone. And finally, consider this. After years of concern over the death of the book, the paper book, there are signs it's actually going in the opposite direction. A bookstore in the UK recently announced that they were going to stop selling e-readers because they needed the floor space back for their books. And perhaps we need no other sign that Amazon, yes, the original bookshop killer, actually opened up a real bookshop in Seattle this past month. The kind with a door and bookshelves. So I think what's going on is that we simply crave real experiences, the ones that we can't get online or through our devices. From feeling the weight of that record and loving the cover art, to opening that brand new book and playing a board game with friends, or gathering those still warm eggs from the chicken coop. And no matter the inconvenience, no matter the time and the cost, many of us are prepared to invest in experiences of the real kind.
So maybe it's not really about old technology versus new technology, or a power struggle between us and the tech elites. It's about age-old human nature. We crave connection and authentic experiences that make us feel connected to the things we like, and no technology will trump this.
So, why did we choose this topic? Well, because what we want to do with the Egg Carton is not only consider the shiny new things, not only talk about innovation. What we want to do is be well-rounded and get you to think about why we can't let go of the old stuff too. Are we right? Is keeping backyard chickens and collecting vinyl actually about craving authenticity? About seeking a real connection? Or are people just looking for cool, trendy experiences to put in their Facebook and Instagram feeds? Or is it to inspire a skit on Portlandia? Listeners, what do you think? You can get in touch. Go to our website, theeggcarton.ca, and leave us some thoughts, or tweet us, @listentotheegg. Our program today was produced by us, Samantha Hodder.
And Nina Woods.
Special thanks goes out to Hannah Krishner and her infamous chickens in Brooklyn, to Julian Seth Wong at Tonality Records in Toronto, and to Eliane Glazer in the UK. We'll be back next time with more ideas, more stories, and more people to meet. Until that time, thanks for listening.